I am Plata on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia, at thecommentary.ca. Publications from the Daily Telegraph to the New York Times and various ones on both sides of the Atlantic have hailed the recent Winston Churchill biography by Andrew Roberts as the best single-volume book on the life of the former British Prime Minister, journalist, soldier, and one of the iconic towering figures of the 20th century. Churchill, Walking with Destiny, is over 1,000 pages and one of over 1,000 books on the man. Yet Roberts, with new material, breathes life yet again into Churchill. One of over 40 new sources are the private diaries of King George VI. I ask Mr. Roberts, who joins me now, about material like that, as well as the qualities of leadership that propelled Churchill to the fore in Britain and throughout the then empire. Roberts also looks at the mistakes that Churchill made and how he learned from those. We also discuss Churchill's drinking, whether he had depression, as well as how portrayals of Churchill on film and television have ranked. Andrew Roberts was in town last week for appearances with the Churchill Society of British Columbia, one of many long-standing organizations devoted to the memory of Churchill, organizations that Andrew has regularly spoken to around the world now. Andrew Roberts is a distinguished biographer and historian whose books include Salisbury, Victorian Titan, Master and Commanders, The Storm of War, Napoleon the Great, and many more, many of which have won awards. He is a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature and the Royal Historical Society. He is a trustee of the International Churchill Society. He is also a visiting professor at the Department of War Studies at King's College London and the Roger and Martha Mertz Visiting Research Fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. Visit andrew-roberts.net. This book is published by Allen Lane, an imprint of Penguin Books. Please welcome to the Plante Online program, Andrew Roberts. Mr. Roberts, good morning.
Hello, good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's a delight to be on the show. Thank you very much.
So you're speaking in Vancouver while you're in town to the Churchill Society here. That's something that you've done in many cities across the world. What is it like for you to see that so many people are devoted to Churchill as they are?
It's incredibly heartening, really, that somebody who died, obviously, over half a century ago should still be able to move people in the way that Winston Churchill does. I've seen, as you say, in many countries, I think 8 countries I've gone to, and many states of the United States, and here in Canada I'm going to be speaking in Vancouver and Calgary, Edmonton, Ottawa and Toronto. And wherever I go, I see this fantastic outpouring of affection for this man, even, as I say, half a century after his death.
And despite his imperfections, which you talk about in the book, Churchill Walking with Destiny, people still have that admiration for him. And that's what makes him relevant still, right?
Well, I actually think overall the imperfections add to it. Nobody really wants to read a book about somebody who's perfect. There are very few people who are perfect in life. And when historians and biographers try to make out their subjects to be perfect, they lose the credibility of their readers, and rightly so, because so people really are. And Winston Churchill made many, many blunders in his life, and I'm very clear about that. And overall, however, I do think that his positive aspects and the things he got right completely overawe those mistakes that he made.
We'll talk about some of those mistakes in just a sec, but these qualities that Churchill has that leaders of today ought to emulate. I mean, one wonders if those qualities, because they come from a certain time and a certain place, Churchill was an Edwardian after all, are they transferable to today?
Oh, I think they are, yes. You're right. Of course, he was an Edwardian, and therefore one must see him in his own context. But I think that that some of the most extraordinary abilities of his eloquence, his foresight, his capacity to bring people together, and share these qualities, things that have been in ancient Athens and and throughout history after that. And I think that Churchill is a great exemplar of all of those things. But I don't think the day is anywhere near that we can do without leaders who exhibit them.
I'm sure when you started writing this book, a lot of people told you that perhaps because there were so many books on Churchill, maybe you shouldn't. I mean, you've written at least five books already where Churchill is a main character. Was there any thought in your mind to not do this book, say?
Oh, yes, absolutely. My wife asked why on earth I was so hubristic to write another biography of Churchill when there are 1,009 at the moment that have been written. Why on earth impose a 1,010th on the topic? But what I knew was that in the last 6 to 10 years, there has been an absolute avalanche of new sources about Winston Churchill that have been made available. I was the first Churchill biographer, for example, to be allowed to use the King's diaries, King George VI's diaries, because the Queen allowed me to read them in the Royal Archives, and there have been 41 sets of papers that have been deposited at Churchill College, Cambridge, since the last major biography of him. The Russian ambassador of the day, Ivan Maisky, his diaries have been made available in Moscow, and I myself, 6 years ago, found the War Cabinet verbatim accounts. And the Churchill family have also allowed me to use papers that haven't been used before, including Mary Soames, Winston Churchill's daughter's wartime diary. So actually, there's an absolute cornucopia of new information, which means that I can have something on this book. Pretty much every page of this book has got something quoted that has never been quoted in any of those 1,009 biographies before.
Now, when you would look at George VI's diaries, were there limits as to what you'd write about? I mean, did they have to stay about Churchill?
No limits whatsoever. It's one of the very pleasing things about the fact that they waited for 79 years after 1940 to allow these papers to be available, that they weren't censored at all. So I didn't feel that I was under any obligation at all to self-censor.
And have you spoken to the Queen about her experiences with Churchill at all?
No, very, very sadly, considering that she's one of the few people who knew Churchill. Very sadly, Her Majesty the Queen does not give interviews. So it's a great shame that. I do hope that in her own diary.
Yeah,
and in her own papers, which obviously won't be made available in my lifetime, but certainly will one day, that she does record what she was talking to Winston Churchill about in her audiences, for example, like her father did.
Yeah, that's the other thing that I was thinking about just now, is that there will still be more written about Churchill years from now, because papers like that will come around.
Of course, no. Of course they will. And in people's attics and in people's private papers, you still get some very interesting reminiscences and letters and diaries and correspondence, which lets fresh light in on Churchill. So, oh yes, no, I don't for a moment believe that the 1,010th will be the last biography of Churchill ever written either.
Right. In the diaries of George the Sixth, you get tremendous insight into the relationship with Churchill. And the thing that I guess just realized as I was reading your book was, they famously got on, and that's what we know, I guess, heretofore. But I mean, that relationship took a while to develop, didn't it?
Yes, there was no real reason why Churchill and the King should have got on, because, of course, the King was a huge staunch supporter of Neville Chamberlain and the policy of appeasement. And Churchill was a big supporter of Edward VIII, the King's elder brother at the time of the abdication. And so they could get the chance of not going on. But, of course, the crisis facing the country was such that they really did, very quickly. And also the King was trusted by Churchill with all of the great secrets of the Second World War. The nuclear secret, the ultra-decrypt secret which countries were going to be attacked and which ministers were going to be hired and fired, for example. And so very quickly, they made a great friendship. In fact, the King uses the word friend when he's describing Churchill in his diaries. And this was something that mattered a great deal to both of them.
Yeah. Now, Churchill and the special relationship, I mean, how he viewed America prior to its entry into the war, did he view them as an inevitable part of the war? Because you write in the book just about how frustrated he was with them, largely Roosevelt. That's right.
And actually, you've got the right word there, frustrated. He felt a tremendous sense of frustration with the glacial speed with which Roosevelt and his administration moved towards bellicosity in the Second World War. Churchill saw that war as a great struggle between civilization and democracy on one side and the most evil dictatorship ever to besmirch human history on the other. And he couldn't understand why, although lots of countries, such as Canada, were very early to fight the war, the United States was very, very late.
And that's something that I found interesting, because eventually the relationship between Roosevelt and Churchill was quite close. He really felt for Roosevelt, and we read of that, I guess, upon news of Roosevelt's death. Churchill, quite emotional. And I did that surprise you as you were doing research for this book, that he cried a lot, say?
Oh, yes, he really was emotional. He cried some 50 times during the Second World War. He'd cry about all sorts of things. And this was because he was a man driven by his passions and his emotions, much more than most British people of his age and class and background in that Victorian era. Uh-huh. And you see again and again him being moved to tears by all sorts of things.
And some people might read that and say, well, that's a symptom of this depression that everybody considers that he had. I mean, when he would talk about Black Dog, people think, you know, he did suffer from depression. But what did you find out about that aspect of his life, say?
He only used the expression Black Dog once in his entire life, which was in July 1911 when he was writing to his wife. And at that time, the phrase was used by matrons, Edwardian matrons and governesses, to explain their bad-tempered children. I don't believe he had depression for one moment. He got depressed, undoubtedly. Uh-huh. There were very depressing moments of the Second World War when any sentient, but the idea that he was subject to chemical imbalances that made him manic depressive, or as even seen bipolar disorder diagnosed by some historians, I think is completely wrong. And actually, he chaired over 1,000 meetings of the this idea that he had physical illness, depression is.
Now, in terms of how he envisioned his life, I mean, he really saw himself at a young age as someone wanting to be great. The title of your book is Walking with Destiny. How much of what he became is, say, predestined, and how much of it was luck, do you think?
A great deal was indeed luck. But he saw luck and destiny, providence, fate, chance, as being all the same thing, and writes about them in his book, Thoughts and Adventures. And I take the title, the subtitle of my book, from the statement that he made in his war memoirs when he was talking about becoming Prime Minister on the 10th of May 1940, that all my past life has been but a preparation for this hour and this trial. He said he was walking with destiny. And it strikes me that this was a very important aspect of Churchill, his belief in a personal and private destiny.
And how fair was he in terms of writing about himself? Because he did write quite a bit. Did you find that he was, say, honest about himself when he had to be?
He tended to exaggerate a bit in his autobiography, My Early Life. But this was because he was writing about things that were happening in the 1880s and 1890s, and he was writing in 1930, so a good 3 or 4 decades afterwards. And I think most of us, when telling anecdotes about our early lives, tend to embroider ever so slightly. And Winston Churchill can be accused of doing that, but not in an egregious way.
A lot of things as I was reading the book, Andrew, there was a couple of what-ifs, and I'd like to touch on those. The Cold War, could Churchill have ended that earlier, do you think?
Well, he wanted to, and he tried to, but the fact is that by the mid-1950s, when he was interested in attempting to do this, Britain was no longer the world power that it had been, and the decision to end the Cold War was very much one that had to be taken by the Americans and the Russians rather than by us. And so as a result, I think there was a slight aspect of folie de grandeur about his posturings, really, by that part of the end of his peacetime premiership.
Did he see Stalin, though, for who he was?
He was the first person to see Stalin for who he was. In his great Iron Curtain speech at Fulton, Missouri, that he made at Fulton in Missouri in March 1946, he warned about Stalin and the dangers that the Soviet Union posed to Eastern Europe and freedom in Eastern Europe. And everybody was furious with him and denounced him and called him a warmonger and so on. And then slowly, of course, they realized that he'd been right all along.
Yeah. I'm sure you're asked, Andrew, about whether Churchill would have been for Brexit. I mean, one would think he was, you know, when he used that phrase, the United States of Europe. Have you any thoughts as to how he might have felt, say, about that?
Yes, he certainly did use the phrase, the United States of Europe. Indeed, he coined that phrase, and he also said, let Europe unite. And of course he did, because he'd seen so many times in his life what he called the struggle between Teuton and Gaul, killing so many of his friends, both in the First World War and, of course, in the Second World War. And so he never wanted to see that happen again. However, he's also very clear, both in his speeches, his great speeches in The Hague and Zurich and so on, at Strasbourg, that he didn't want Britain to be part of this European project. He wanted Britain to be a supporter and an ally and so on, but he put the Commonwealth and also the special relationship with the United States, another phrase that he coined in that Iron Curtain speech I mentioned earlier, before any attempt to subsume British sovereignty in a European project. So he's in favor of it happening. He just didn't think Britain should be a member of it.
Right. Now, these mistakes that he made, and you are indeed fair in the book about them, and you cover them in the book. What's the lesson here for the rest of us in terms of how we view the errors that we inevitably make in life? I mean, how did he view them? I mean, did he, he obviously learned from them, didn't he?
That's the key thing, I think. When you see a politician make an error, it shouldn't be the end of their career, so long as they learn from them. And Winston Churchill very much learned from his mistakes. His greatest mistake probably in his entire life was the Dardanelles appalling expedition that took place in 1915 that led to so many people killed and wounded in the Gallipoli expedition. And he learned from that never to overrule the chiefs of staff. In the Second World War, he never once overruled the chiefs of staff, which he was constantly, constitutionally quite capable of doing as he wanted to. He was Minister of Defence as well as Prime Minister, but he never did. And you see again and again in his life him making mistakes, undoubtedly. And of course he did, because he was at the top of British politics for two-thirds of a century. But he learned from them, and I think that's what differentiates him, and also what makes him a good role model for ourselves today.
Indeed. The reviews for your book have been universally great. One lukewarm review, though, wondered if Churchill is so mythic that we really don't see the real Churchill. Do you think you've revealed him at all in the real Churchill, say, in this book?
I missed that review, I'm pleased to say. Otherwise, I was very happy that at least a dozen of them have called this book the best single volume biography ever written of Churchill. Uh-huh. So yes, I very much do think that I've revealed more about him. You mentioned earlier all the new sources which I've mined quite extensively. I've been thinking about this man now for certainly 30 years since I've been writing books, five of them with his name in the title or the subtitle. So it would be remiss of me if I didn't admit to you that I very much do think that I've presented a man in the round, somebody who, as I say, made mistakes, but who learned from them, somebody who had a tremendous sense of foresight, proved, of course, not just after the Second World War in the Iron Curtain speech, but also before the First and Second World Wars, somebody who had tremendous physical courage, but also moral courage which equaled it. And therefore really was somebody who we should look at again, both in terms of leadership, but also just simply in terms of his own story and the remarkable way that he was able, with his eloquence and his wit and his leadership, to warn us against two of the twin evils of the 20th century.
Now, one myth or one legend, I guess, that surrounds Churchill is the drinking. In terms of what you were able to find out about that, his intake was just tremendous. What explains that? I mean, did he drink as much as he's reported to have drunk? I mean, he did live to 90, and so one wonders then if that was all true, say.
Yes, it was. No. He did drink this amount. There's no doubt about that. But he wasn't an alcoholic. He had a body that could process alcohol to the most remarkable degree. There's only one occasion in the whole of the Second World War, the full 2,198 days of the Second World War, when he was drunk. And that's quite something, it seems to me. With his great friend, C.P. Scott, said of him, the journalist said, Winston Churchill couldn't have been an alcoholic because no alcoholic could have drunk that much.
Yeah.
I think it's a great line, and it does actually very much sum up the truth about Churchill, which was that he had an ox-like constitution for alcohol.
And throughout the day, he would, I mean, you write in the book about Paul Roget, for example, he would drink, would he drink different things?
No, not throughout the day. There are two examples that I know of where he started drinking before lunchtime, but he didn't. He was not a morning drinker. That really is remarkable for alcoholism. He would have a glass of champagne before lunch, one or two would be second course, and then he would very often have a glass or two of brandy. And that would be lunchtime, which would knock a lot of us out. But then he'd repeat the same thing at dinner, and he'd also have some whiskey and soda, very, very light. His private secretary told me that it was really just mouthwash. Mm. But nonetheless, it would be on the go until pretty much 3 o'clock in the morning.
Right. Now, the cover of your book is the photo by Karsh, and I mean, it's a photo that a lot of us have seen, I guess, over the years. Is the way Karsh photographed him, I mean, that's the way that a lot of us see him, isn't it?
And so we should, yes. It was taken in Ottawa, of course, it was one of the iconic images of him, perhaps the most iconic image of him. Karsh stated in his autobiography that he got the image by taking a cigar out of Churchill's mouth.
Right.
And the scowl that that he caught only seconds later came as a result of Churchill having had this young man remove the cigar from his mouth. Whether that's true or not, I like to believe that it is certainly Karsh said it was.
Now, portrayals of Churchill in film and television, I mean, there were at least two movies in recent, I can think of three now in the last couple of years. What stands out for you in terms of the best portrayal, say, of Winston Churchill?
Well, let me start with the worst. That was the terrible movie Churchill, called Churchill in 2017, in which he was portrayed as not wanting D-Day to succeed, completely absurd movie which should never have been made, the Brian Cox one, in which I actually count 120 factual errors in the course of the 2 hours of the movie. So don't bother with that one. However, I did like Darkest Hour very much. I thought that Gary Oldman really caught Churchill brilliantly. All his wonderful chuckles and the glint in his eye and the prosthetics that Oldman used were really first class, I thought. The only drawback, of course, with that movie was the scene in the tube station, the subway,
where
it was implied that Churchill used a sort of focus group of ordinary British people in order to decide to carry on fighting on against Hitler, which is completely wrong. In fact, it was the other way round. It was the British people who took from Churchill the courage to continue the struggle.
Yeah. What did you make of Albert Finney's portrayal of him?
Yes, I enjoyed that very much. I think Roll Hardy also, of course, must stand as one of the greats. The film, the series, The Wilderness Years of the 1970s,
right.
I think was really first class as well historically.
Yeah. What one wonders as you're talking about Churchill, as you have around the world now, what the next book will be about. Are you working on something new now?
Yes, I'm writing a biography of King George III. I'd like to try and persuade Americans in particular that he was not the pantomime villain of the musical Hamilton, nor the terrible tyrant of the Declaration of Independence,
right.
But was in fact an enlightened monarch and a Renaissance prince. And he was just very unlucky to have shared the same decade as so many of those extremely talented founding fathers of theirs.
Yeah. It's been such a pleasure to talk to you about this book. It's a book that I've enjoyed reading, all the adulation that it's gotten is certainly well deserved. I so appreciate your time today. Thanks for this, Andrew.
You are kind. I very much enjoyed being on the show. Goodbye.
The book is called Churchill Walking with Destiny. It is published by Allen Lane, which is an imprint of Penguin Books. Its author, Andrew Roberts, joined me early last week here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plantum.